and things in Thoreau's book that might either seem religiously, in religious terms, irrelevant or offensive, you know, in a Christian frame of values, make sense within a Buddhist frame of values. And that's the frame I'd like to suggest, and I have no commitment to that. You know, it's by no means saying that we're, the next sessions will always come back to this. It's just one perspective on it. Actually, if you read any distance into this, you'll realize that what's crucial to Thoreau is two things that John had put on the board the other day. One is how trivial poetry, if one only stops at the text, or the only truths that you can know are truths that you put into practice. That was just axiomatic to Thoreau. That's behind this. So I it would be kind of a, one might almost say a waste of time, though it's often done, to go through the text in a literary kind of way. And we can do that occasionally, look at passages, you know, if you'd like to. I thought what would be more meaningful, though, in most of the sessions, is to deal with people who have, in fact, taken the truths that Thoreau raises here and have tested them in their own lives, or are in the process of testing them. To bring your own experience to bear in that way, and to make those the discussions. And I begin by the immediate confession that, in fact, I have not tested these truths in my own life. So I am supremely unqualified to lead such a discussion. That's, for starters, I talk about Buddhism. Well, actually, I've had some experience, concrete experience with Buddhism. But what we'll be doing next time is the session will be led by John and Mary Schramm, who went into West Virginia, to Appalachia, and built a home. As I understand, I haven't talked in great detail, but put the boards, constructed the house, dug a hole for a privy, dug a well, did everything from scratch, raised food, started a farm, and lived there for 6 years. They hung in there for 4 years longer than Thoreau. I think that would be interesting to talk about that experience. You might have questions you'd want to bring from your reading.
You want to make it more dramatic than it was, so that it's an exciting hour? Or,
No. Oh, you know, no, you don't?
Yes.
Also, I mean, what is interesting is that their lives in the period before that, they were in, as they've mentioned in several contexts, in Washington, D.C., in the midst of turmoil and social history, in the capital of power, where, you know, making and shaping happens, and to move from that context into the other one, I think would make that experience all the richer. Then the next session after that will be led by Joel, who is a farmer's son, grew up on a farm, who's an enthusiast for Wendell Berry, a 20th century day Thoreau, who was himself lives on the land as a small farm in Kentucky and writes out of that experience, and who Joel is in the process himself of setting up Tocoa, which is a way of interpreting religious mission in terms of the land, care of the land, whatever. And so is in another person who is in the process of embodying, has been, and is continuing to embody the truths that are here, struggle with them, come to terms with them, and live the experience. And then finally, Tom will lead the third session on civil disobedience, tax resistance. Thoreau does not mention this in Walden. It was a part of his Walden experience, midway through those 2 years in Walden. In the book itself, it's condensed into a single year for rhetorical clarity, just for organizational clarity. But in fact, he spent, in literal time, 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days there. And in the middle of that experience was when he went into Concord, as he called it, strolled in, and Sam Staples, local constable, you know, everybody knew everybody in Concord said, Henry or Hank, whatever, you know, you're going through the records and you haven't paid your poll tax in the last several years. I know how these things slip up, you know, we're not that tight here, but, you know, you can pay it now. Throughout warned him, you know, he hadn't paid it in several years and didn't intend to pay it in the coming years. He said, well, I'm going to have to put you in jail, you know. I understand that. Sam, put him in jail, and that night an elderly woman, unidentified, people conjecture it was his Aunt Maria, paid the tax for him, and he went and he was out. And there were a lot of rumors about, you know, what was Thoreau doing? He was always this kind of crazy guy anyway. What is he trying to do to us now? And so he gave a lecture in the Concord Lyceum on this, on why I did what I did, what I did. And this was the essay, Civil Disobedience. And Tom will speak to that, again, from the perspective of present-day tax resistance. He didn't pay the tax because he was opposed to slavery and the war in Mexico, which he saw as an imperialist war. It was on principle that he refused. So that was a part of, in a sense, his Walden experience, though it is not in the book Walden itself. That's one reason why Civil Disobedience is often reprinted with it. Okay, so the bulk of the sessions on Walden will be of this sort. Let's see, led by people who kind of tested these truths in some way, wrestled with them concretely, practically in their own lives, your own experiences in this regard, and a kind of give and take on this, which I think is the only way Thoreau would want his book to be handled. So this first session is a bit atypical in that regard. It's one kind of theoretical frame. I might begin, though, by sketching a little, not giving a whole bio on Thoreau, but talking about the kind of man he was as he wrote this. And actually, he's the kind of person that might have come to Holden. He was at a place in his life that many of you would have been. The one thing that he would have found offensive at Holden and just intolerable, assume that he didn't know much about it and come up here with vague sense of his values, the required vespers he would have found intolerable. Nothing else, I think, about the place he would have, but he would have at first probably tried to compromise and drift into the library and farther even back into the building. And then finally, after a week, he would have come and said, I've been thinking about this required worship, and it doesn't make any sense to me, so I'm going to have to leave. And he would leave. Maybe he wouldn't have even come into a community anyway. But where he was is he had attended Harvard, gotten a liberal arts education, and that was quite a privilege in those days. His favorite subjects were the Roman and Greek classics, natural history, mathematics. And then after graduation, he had a difficult time finding what he would do. He started teaching school, but because he was unwilling, temperamentally unable, to impose punishment, especially corporal punishment, on students, he didn't work out as a teacher very quickly. He tried working in the family pencil business. They made pencils. And that didn't work out. He, with his brother John, he started a progressive school where there would be no punishment. And that kind of had a shaky going. And then when his brother got very ill after 3 years, that collapsed. So at 28, he was still drifting. He was still wondering what he was going to do when he grew up or whatever. And he lived in a small town. He was born in Concord, and he really made only three trips out of it, one to Maine, one as far as Minnesota. So there was a lot of, we talk about community, that was kind of a closed community. Everyone knew everyone else. And his neighbors resented him. And you may know this, if your parents, you know, your parents spent a lot of money to send you to a good school, give you an education, and they expect you to do something with that. You don't just take that and then horse around afterward or continue staring into your navel and wondering what it all means. I mean, right, well, Thoreau was one of those people. I mean, he just still couldn't hadn't figured out what he was going to do. In the early 40s, in his early 20s, he decided that he would be a poet, started keeping a journal. Some of this, by the way, is relevant to that writing class. He thought he would be a poet, and it was only in the mid-50s that that sort of faltering. Actually, it turned out he would be a great writer, but not at all in the way he conceived, but in the form he conceived. But he kept it, started keeping a journal. And so he went off into the woods. His friend Emerson, who became a kind of mentor and who was one of the great and most respected figures in America at the time, kind of guru, had some land. Thoreau had become a kind of disciple to him, and Thoreau went out to Walden and as a way of coming to terms with life, as he says, maybe, the central purpose is in what I lived in and where I lived and what I lived for. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swathe and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Or if it were sublime, to know it by experience. That's the crucial phrase, Thoreau. To know it by experience, and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. For most men, it appeared to me, are in a strange uncertainty about it, whether it is of the devil or of God, and have somewhat hastily concluded that it is the chief end of man here to, quote, glorify God and enjoy him forever. He wanted to test that before saying it, instead of just taking it on second hand. Well, okay, do it to test it. Okay. He was 28 when he did that. And then after roughly 2 years, Emerson was going off to Europe for a tour and said, would you stay with my wife and kids, you know, while I'm away? And Thoreau had great affection for Emerson's family, said, sure. So he left Walden. He had no commitment, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I've committed my life to Walden, I'm have this, and so I can't leave. It'll be an inconsistency, a violation of my integrity. No, I had a good reason for leaving, so I left and stayed with Emerson's wife and family, and that experience ended. It was some years later. He tried to get it published somewhat unsuccessfully. Originally, there had been a previous book that he had published. It had sold just 250 copies. It was another early failure. And the publisher then just dumped 700 copies to the remainder on his doorstep. So there was somewhat reluctance to publish another book by this man. And it was in the mid-50s or 54 when it was published. And there, it did sell. There were only two books Thoreau's that were published in his lifetime. This was one. I'll leave that. Later, in Thoreau's career, he became a very active abolitionist, a participant in the Underground Railroad, a very good speaker. For the abolitionist cause. At one time, he was asked to step in for Frederick Douglass, and Douglass was unable to make a speaking engagement. And, he died in 62 at the age of 45, in the middle of the Civil War. Now I would like to kind of place Thoreau in an Eastern context. As you read through Walden, you'll discover that, in fact, he refers to Vedantic literature far more than he does the Bible explicitly. When he wants to quote a sacred text or wisdom, he turns either to a Chinese or an Indian source in the Bible. And he claimed at one time that he was formed by two books, Emerson's Nature essay, Nature, and Emerson's writing generally, and the Bhagavad Gita, the sacred text of Hinduism, or the most popular. And actually, that's two ways of saying he was influenced by the East, because Emerson was even more deeply influenced by Eastern thought than Thoreau was. So in a sense, he was getting that influence two ways, Americanized, of course, in Thoreau. Emerson, or both Emerson and Thoreau had full libraries of text in translation, primary text in translation, and commentaries. Oddly, though, I have come across no concrete evidence that he was familiar with Buddhism, though it seems to me that the spirit of Walden is even more Buddhist than Hindu. And that's the context I'd like to place him in. And here's, I'll suggest some evidence for it, but here's one. The Buddha is actually a title like the Christ. That was not, the Buddha's name was not the Buddha, just as Christ's last name was not Christ, Jesus Christ. His name was Gautama Siddhartha. Siddhartha meaning one whose aim is accomplished. That was his surname. Gautama was his given name. Sukyas was the clan name. And the title of the Buddha comes from the wood up there. Means awakened. The Buddha is one who was awakened. In Religions of Man, Houston Smith offers this dialogue. When the Buddha began teaching, people around him and became very impressed by him. He seemed extraordinary, more than human. They were drawn to him as disciples were drawn to Christ, overwhelmed. And he was asked, "Who are you? What are you?" Actually, was the question. "Are you a god?" they asked. "No." "An angel?" "No." "A saint?" "No." "Then what are you?" The Buddha answered, "I am awake."
Any noise behind, it's very hard to hear.
Okay. So the Buddha originally claimed,
what did he say?
I am awake.
Okay.
He was very emphatic on this throughout his life. He was no god. He was no savior. He was no angel. Didn't even claim to be a saint. I mean, on the historical record, quite clearly, he's subsequently been turned into a savior and a god of sorts, but historically, there's no evidence. He was a teacher. He had awakened to a truth, and he was teaching that truth. The central metaphor that seems to me in the introduction and the conclusion of Walden is precisely this of awakening. This is the word that in the beginning of his book and at the end of his book, Thoreau comes back to again and again. And in fact, on page 66, the word awaken, awake, or awakening appears 12 times, literally. And then, of course, in metaphorical terms of morning, dawn, and implied by slumber, it covers the page. Just to suggest this, on page the bottom of 65, every morning was a cheerful invitation to make my life of equal simplicity, and I may say innocence, with nature herself. I got up early and bathed in the pond. That was a religious exercise, and one of the best things which I did. Jumping down further, he quotes a Chinese source, "Renew thyself completely each day. Do it again and again, forever again." Then on 66, I'll just read some of the passages to give the sense of him stressing this word, awake, and that this is what he's doing. "The morning, which is the most memorable season of the day, is the awakening hour. Then there is least solemnness in us, and for an hour at least, some part of us awakes, which slumbers all the rest of the day and night. Little is to be expected of that day, if it can be called a day to which we have not awakened by our genius, but by the mechanical nudgings of some servitor, and are not awakened by our newly acquired force and aspirations from within, accompanied by the undulations of celestial music, instead of factory bells and fragrance filling the air, to a higher life than we fell asleep from." Jumping down, "The Vedas say, all intelligences awake with the morning. Poetry and art and the fairest and most memorable of actions of men date from that hour." Passing through sentences where he talks about aurora, sunrise, perpetual morning. "Morning is when I am awake and there is dawn in me. Moral reform is the effort to throw off sleep. Why is it that men give so poor an account of their day if they have not been slumbering? They have not. They are not such poor calculators. If they are not, if they have not been overcome with drowsiness, they would have performed something. The millions are awake enough for physical labor, but only one in a million is awake enough for effective intellectual exertion, and only one in 100 millions to a poetic or divine life. To be awake is to live. I have never yet met a man who was quite awake. How could I have looked him in the face? We must learn to awaken and to keep ourselves awake. Well, go on, but one can say that he's making a point or stressing. And then the last, at the very end of conclusion, it's an image that recurs in this a number of times in the conclusion, but at the very end, just before the last sentences of Walden, the light which puts out our eyes is darkness to us. Only that day dawns to which we are awake. There is more day to dawn. The sun is but a morning star. But that's not the main emphasis that I want to draw, just the kind of literalizing connecting. But I'd like to explore what the Buddha saw as spiritual life, what he brought to his people. And I guess I'll just forget about a lot of the biography or the story of his life behind it. But at the age of 29, encountering, disturbed by experiences of death, sickness, illness, loss, not in his own life, but in others, he set out in pursuit of truth. His parents had tried to protect him from such realities. And he tried two things that, of course, you would try if you were in India of his day. One was the wisdom of the Brahmins. He studied, he was from the warrior class, not the Brahmin class. He studied Vedantic wisdom. And theology was big business. What we might call theology was big business in India then. It still is. Just all kinds of theories about the cosmos, about God, about you name it, any spiritual problem. And he studied that, was quite gifted in it, and saw that ultimately that was not what he was looking for. That was not an answer. So he rejected that. And then he tried asceticism, just living, eating almost nothing. And again, he was superlatively good at that, so that he could feel his backbone, you know, kind of became almost literally a skeleton. And that didn't work. And the reason, well, and then he sat under the Bo tree, Bo enlightenment, just rooted himself down, determined to stay there until he could come to enlightenment, to the truth, and in an incredible night filled with temptations and God knows what, he arrived at enlightenment, the Four Noble Truths. His last temptation was actually an interesting one. It bears on the future of Buddhism, and it's the one most frequently recounted, and that is, having attained enlightenment, he could say, fine, I got what I wanted, go away. Or, the challenge was, he could teach what he had learned. But the voice of Satan whispered in his ear, how can you possibly teach this to people? It's going to seem like idiocy to them. You know, you're just going to get a lot of grief and hassle, and they aren't going to understand what you're saying. Why do it? You can't do it. This kind of enlightenment, such as you've discovered, can only come through experience. People who haven't experienced it aren't going to fathom it. That was the strongest temptation the Buddha encountered, simply to, having attained enlightenment, to rest in it. And he chose not to. He chose to become a teacher. Okay. He was by nature, one can see from his teaching, here I'm drawing on Smith's account, which I think is a very good one. Oddly, it might seem odd in someone who was an Indian, very practical and pragmatic. What distinguishes the teachings of Buddha, whether they were empirical, pragmatic, psychological, therapeutic, and he taught what is called Four Noble Truths, and it was another term for it is the middle way between extremes. he experienced the extremes of theological speculation, on and on and on, you know, forever in that direction, or asceticism. And extremity of religious life seemed to him pointless, and it became an end in itself. And so he argued that what one needed was a moderate asceticism, if it could be called asceticism at all. That is, you gave yourself the necessities of life so that your body was in optimum condition. You didn't deny the body anything that it needed: food, shelter, clothing. He claimed, though, that you'd be surprised how little the body actually does need. You give yourself no more. The crucial thing was, you give yourself enough. Don't deny yourself anything that you genuinely need, but no more than enough. Everything beyond the enough brings pain, rather than additional comfort. So again, just a very pragmatic approach. How much do you deny yourself? Well, how much do you need? That's how much you take. You don't take more than you need. The Four Noble Truths. He asked himself, what is the essential truth of life? What is life? And it seemed to him it was suffering. Dukkha, word up there. And in Pali, that word, Smith points out, is often used, it has a metaphorical meaning of an axle that's out of its, or what is that, shaft out of the axle, a bone that slipped from its socket that creates pain, an off-centeredness, a dislocation. That the suffering of human beings is a dislocatedness, an off-centeredness that creates pain and friction. Second noble truth was, and that suffering is everywhere. Again, he illustrated, you know, you think life isn't suffering. Well, let's look at it in detail. There are the obvious forms of suffering. Growing old, the pain, for example, even before Freud, he pointed out that birth was traumatic and painful, and the memory of that pain, birthing for the infant, remains with you. The Buddhist, by the way, is some people have claimed that it isn't a religion, that in fact what the Buddhist was an acute psychologist. And in fact, by and large, that's how he presented himself. You know, growing old, loss of friends, loss of love, whatever. And then even things that you think source of happiness, suffering there. Why is there so much suffering? And the second noble truth, desire, but again, that can be misunderstood. Basically, what it means is that pain is caused by worshiping or living within one's ego, trying to pull the world into one's ego. That's what desire is. Hunger to stuff things into the ego, for me, for the self. It's like, you know, the ego were a suitcase and you were jamming it, coming up to hold it with as much as you could possibly get in there, and then you crawl in yourself and zip it up. So that the only way to escape from suffering is to get out of the ego, to transcend it, to escape from it. And there were actually two ways of escaping from the ego into and Godhead. The problem of occasionally we'll bring in religious or metaphysical terms. One of the things that the Buddha did, part of his pragmatism, is that he refused to deal with any metaphysical questions. You know, is there a God? What is God like? What's the cosmos like? Consistence, God, no, who knows? Don't ask me. Just refute theoretical speculation, I'm not interested in. What works? What's in practice? That's all I want to deal with. So it's very unclear, just, you know, surely the Buddha had some metaphysical presupposition. For example, we know one that he just assumed was reincarnation, and there were a number of other Hindu beliefs that he accepted, but he just refused to speak to them. But sure, very likely, a Hindu belief that he did have that's implied by a system is that one can get into Godhead or Nirvana either deep within what we call immanence or outside in otherness. Each route is beyond the ego. When we say in, that's not into the ego or me or, you know, whatever. It's through the ego to an inwardness that's other than the ego, deeper than the ego, or outside. You encounter God in both ways. Our own paradox of transcendence is eminence, eminence is transcendence, the other within. Okay, so that it was this refusal to move beyond the ego, the attempt to pull life, desire, that's what ended this, tanha, into the ego, to shrink the world into the self that creates pain. How then do this? The Eightfold Path was his, again, four practical or eight practical steps to attaining enlightenment. You know, how to do it. If it were an American book, it's four easy steps to the realization of God or enlightenment. And the only thing the Buddha would have pulled out was the easy. The American, how to do it, you know, I'll tell you, you know, specific steps, was something he would have been very sympathetic with. One might talk about all that he repudiated, Houston Smith, in Hinduism of his time. He was a really radical figure. What he rejected seems to be the, as Houston Smith points out, the basics of religion. But he rejected them because it seemed to him that they had become counterproductive in his own day. Tradition, he rejected. And Hindu religion was rich with tradition. Got no interest in it. In fact, he taught, not in Sanskrit, but in Pali, local dialect. Mystery, got no interest in that. It's not mysterious at all. It's very clear. I'll explain to you just what it is. Got no interest in mystification, magic, voodoo, you know, whatever spells. Again, I've seen enough of that. That gets people nowhere. Authority, rejected the caste system. You don't need to be a Brahmin to do what my program for salvation or enlightenment. Whoever you are, you can do it. Spoke to the individual. Rejected ritual. No rituals required. None of this. A saving God? Not at all. You don't wait for God. Don't worry about it. The questions about God, who he is, what he does, don't set that aside. You can do it. And I'll show you how to do it. And the test of what I tell you is simply this: does it work? When I tell you something, it's not because it's good in some absolute sense, because God wants you to do it, because it works. Try it. And then what did he offer? Well, the eight steps are, and I won't elaborate, right knowledge, right aspiration, right speech, right behavior, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right absorption. In short, what is it? What was he saying? Well, then begin by basically with self-examination. Again, a kind of a program of acute psychology that has a therapeutic end. Look at your life. Look at the way you speak, the words you use. For example, the use of inclusive language. The Buddha, I think, would have been very sympathetic with that. You know, you think you're going to change human relationships without changing the way people speak. You think, you know, pronouns don't matter. You're kidding yourself. Look at the words you use, how you use, attend very carefully to how you speak. Look at your behavior, how you live day to day. Examine your mind, how it works. How do you think? What do you think about? And given that, just look at that. What do you want to do? Kierkegaard's phrase, purity of heart is to will one thing. Central in the Buddhist program, and how not only willing one thing, but willing it intensely. What do you do for a living? You know, do you work for public relations in Coca-Cola? Don't kid yourself. You know, you want to do that, you don't want what I have to offer. You can't, there's some jobs you can't be in and practically get where I want you to go. And there is, in this teaching, it's very rational. It's very analytical, and there's a belief that the problem is not corruption of will, but ignorance. Examine your life, examine it thoroughly, understand it, and you can attain enlightenment. The last one, which is we associate with Buddhism, is right absorption, and this deals with the yogas, forms of meditation, though actually there's a rather narrow notion in the West of what yoga involves. We think of it as hatha yoga, turning into a pretzel and thinking, or maybe just looking at a candle. Actually, there are all kinds of yogas. The word our word yoke comes from the Sanskrit, same Sanskrit word as yoga, and it has a dual meaning that, that yoke has here of uniting or integrating as yoke together and oxen, yoke together, and discipline, take my yoke upon you, labor. And what it means is just that, through a discipline to attain unity or oneness with the world, with God. And in Hindu tradition, that, that can be attained a number of ways. The reason I mention that is that there are two ways I think one finds in Thoreau of this sort of thing. One is Raja Yoga, which is forms of meditation, what we normally think of as yoga, stillness, attaining stillness. The other is Karma Yoga, which is yoga through work, through labor. Thoreau working in the fields and being very, it's how you do it. If you're working because you want a good crop and you're worried about, you know, what the produce is going to be and you're calculating, you know, how much you're going to make out of this or anything else, it doesn't work. But if you work as a laborer for, and I'll use an un-Buddhist phrase, or a phrase the Buddha wouldn't, for God, if you work selflessly, devotedly, but unmindful of the fruits of that, like the lilies of the field. We often think lilies of the field parable means you're lazy. I mean, you goof off and God takes care of you. It's not so much you labor, but you don't worry about the consequences of your labor. You labor selflessly and very mindfully. That can be a form of yoga in which it's a discipline in which you become united with the world. And Thoreau, I think, illustrates that in a number of ways. Just in Houston Smith, when he talks about this. The karma yogi will try to do each thing as it comes, as if it were the only thing he has to do, and having done it or being forced to leave it, to go on to another duty or to do so in the same spirit. He will seek to concentrate fully and calmly on each duty as it represents itself, resisting all impatience, excitement, and the vain attempt to do or think half a dozen things at once. But once he has done this, he will dissociate himself from the act and let the chips fall where they may. The other yoga is meditation, in which you become still, kind of taken out of yourself. I'll use, this is less frequent in Thoreau, but I'll cite one passage, an illustrative one, where it does occur. This is at the bottom of 83. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I have sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie, amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in an undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiselessly through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. That is, from sunrise until noon, he was totally unaware of time. I mean, he was lost and not even realized he was lost until something brought him to, and that was some 4 hours or more later. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals mean by contemplation and the forsaking of works. Okay. Ultimately, the goal of this then is to get outside oneself, to identify with the world rather than with oneself, so that anything and everything in the world is as precious and valuable, as respected as yourself. And this is not just an idea, but something in your bones. I mean, the point of yoga is not so that you, in theory, say, oh yeah, I see that, right, I agree, but that it's in your blood. And then ultimately beyond that, with nirvana or Godhead, ultimately the arahant or saint goes even beyond identification with the world into God. And that is exquisite joy. I'll end with this, and then we can kind of toss around how this might, from your early reading of Thoreau, bear on Thoreau or not. But I'd like to get at what I think is one essential difference from Christianity in this, and just from my experience, little experience in Asia. One thing that it seems to me, there's a lot, when you can learn about other religions, that religions seem to have in common or share an astonishing amount, but there are also distinctive things that are unique to religions, and it struck me that one thing that's unique to Christianity, it's more an emphasis than something nothing else knows about, is what John has been getting at, the cross, that Christian faith carries people into the world to deal with suffering, justice, pain, to come to terms with this. When I was in Thailand, Cambodian refugees were pouring over the borders by the thousands. The Vietnamese army was right behind them. And the Thais, a fully Buddhist culture, Theravada Buddhism, would have just wished them away, would have wanted to push them back over the border, and would have, very likely, if they could have, except for political pressure and pressure from the West. But they just didn't want to deal with these people. Their suffering was not our suffering. It was largely Christian missionaries and Christian groups that were in the camps looking after people. And even within Thailand, hospitals and schools were often, you know, Christian missionaries were developing them. And I mean, I don't have that much experience, but even when one thinks of third world countries and revolutionary movements or people struggling for liberation, it's kind of Christian people who are there among them in some way, however clumsily they may be working or not working. Partly this is that Buddhism has no interest in proselytizing. They got no interest in converting people to Buddhism, but it's not just that. I think Christians in the world aren't just proselytizing. Okay, but the other thing that struck me that Buddhism had, that Christianity doesn't have, Christians and the Christian church doesn't have, is stillness. A staying put, a sitting down, and becoming quiet and listening. To live in a country where you see the image of the Buddha, and it was an image that never meant anything to me. It was often a fat Buddha. The Thai Buddha is not fat. It's broad shouldered and to a slender waist. The pectoral muscles are developed to suggest breasts slightly. It's a very androgynous image. The face is of indeterminate sex, and the pectoral muscles suggest breasts, and so it's a kind of an androgynous figure with the lotus folded legs and the hand offering peace. And a smile, to me, infinitely more absorbing than the Mona Lisa's smile. But what people talk about, you know.
Okay.
What a kind of profound and moving and consoling image it is. Just a wonderful image to see and be around. And the Asians have not underestimated how difficult it is to quiet the mind. In fact, they're far more aware than Western people of what a paradox that is, to get the mind to be still. They realize that it's a labor that takes a lifetime, that it's an enormous discipline. But when they listen, they don't listen for God to speak. They listen for silence. And when you're the ultimate goal is a silence in which nothing is said by you or by God, and that silence, far from being emptiness, and that's often how Christians seem to interpret this, you know, I've waited, God, I've listened, and you haven't said anything, you haven't spoken to my problem, you know, and said, Emily, I know what you're thinking, you know. You haven't, you know, that this is a bind, I've failed. That if you move, that silence is the silence of where you pressed your ear against the drum of your ego. That is genuine emptiness. That is genuine emptiness. You're right, there's nothing there. But the silence of God is fullness and joy. It's God having entered your being beyond all speech. And compared to that, Christian prayer is such jabbering and busyness. Dear God, we know tomorrow when you make the corn muffins that you will put in the right amount of salt. We know, God, that you will sweep the floors. And again, how much prayer passes for instruction or we know? And this sort of thing, a kind of busyness. In a way, it's related. Christians are active. They're in the world. They're engaged. You know, they're moving. Part of this comes out of Judaism. Oh, you need to, you know, the kind of, if you see the clips on news reports of what's the term for the Israeli parliament? Knesset. Yes. People, when they're going, you know, every day, yeah, everywhere, you know, whenever you go into Israel, people are yelling and compare that with you know, India or just, you know, the Chinese kind of sitting there smiling inscrutably, you know, and one sees the difference. And I think what Thoreau is getting at in his is that as close as an American can come to stillness, to saying no to the demands the world makes upon you, to become quiet. Partly, why do you, he says, I did what I did. I minimize my work. Why? Because that gives me so much time to do nothing, to be still. He didn't do it, as the Buddha didn't recommend, because a lot of people need food and I don't want to eat their food. Or I don't do it, you know, for a lot of moral. I do it because it opens up so much more time to be still. And if there's a frustration to the book, I think it's two things that are in Buddhism. One, it's this careful scrutinizing of mundane, ordinary things, asking the question, what is going on here? Why are we doing this? And what are the consequences? And the pace that Thoreau forces on you of just slowing down so much, and you just want to move, you know, move it along. You know, give me a story. And part of it is it's a style that says, if you don't like reading this page, I've got nothing to say to you. Close the book. I mean, it's an honest in that way. And Thoreau says, close the book, and you're not an evil person, or, you know, less than human, or any, you know, go away. What one has, I think, and then this is a way of opening up, is in economy, which comes, by the way, from the Greek word oikos, which means household. It's the same root for ecology. And I think he's interested in that. A household, in the literal sense of Thoreau's, building a house and setting it up and managing it, is like seeing nature as a huge household. And running it with good stewardship, frugally, so that there is no waste, and that everything is honored. And the connections between everything is acknowledged. And
also, ecumenism.
Yeah.
And economy.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's rich. Well, I guess like
it's
like.
A golden theme for a year from next summer.
Yeah. And even if you get into literal the technical social science of economy, one economist told me it's the science of values. And what Thoreau does here is a kind of Buddhist thing. A cost-benefit analysis of life. Here's what you want, and I'll show you what you're paying for it. And you're paying for it an awful lot more than you think you are. Now, once you see what you're paying for it, you can decide whether you still want to buy it. That's the whole thing of desire, the Buddha. Let's look, you want that, you can have it. If you want it, you can have it, but make sure you know what you're going to pay for it. And you're going to pay an enormous, greater amount for it than you think you are, hidden cost. And he does it in a Buddhist and very American kind of way. I think he's talking about spiritual matters, but he says, you're from Missouri? I know what you mean. You want dollars and cents, nuts and bolts, the bottom line. I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you how much it cost, what I did. I did it. I speak from experience. No highfalutin ideas. We deal with the nitty-gritty. I, you know, give you my budget. How many nails? How many boards? You can see what it is. Very practical. But ultimately, I think what he's talking about is spiritual life. And then at the end, of course, he deals with this question of why not go into the world? How can you justify the Christian challenge, I suppose? How can you justify going off into the woods and gazing into your navel or gazing into Walden Pond when the world, there's so much need out there in the world, so much to do, and it takes up a justification for that. But what I've suggested here is a kind of frame for one spiritual understanding of Walden. I guess I'd open it up to either question or, you know, playing off of it or challenging it, or, you know, whatever, from your reading of Economy, in which he kind of explores his program.
Well, I just have a comment about more folksy source, and that's Fears and Heroes, Head Stop program. And what brought it to my mind is his Head Stop program is for kids to just sit on the back door steps and do nothing. Maybe see how far they can spit or something like that. And it brought out how much children are already programmed to do this, music lessons, sports, scouts, you know, carting them around. And it's just the beginning of a long program.
Here, Jason, it's going to be totally off the wall, but it relates to this too. Your question.
You're already into an Asian mindset. No.
Last summer, Jim Seekers was here for a while, we were talking, and he was talking about having spent 3 months in wandering around pretty much with nothing in India, exploring the particular experience of India. He was quoting the first lieutenant of Maharishi Ashoka Transcendental Meditation Act, saying our ultimate goal is to gather the resources to rid India of the devil Christianity. And this busybody, meddling, and problem-causing entity that we're talking about, and Mother Teresa, was really a big pain in the neck for a lot of people. I'm wondering, in light of what you experienced, how the role of
I can't speak. I think Thoreau might be very sympathetic to it. I think the Indians might not. I haven't been to India, but part of it, it's a different thing. An odd thing for a Christian is to experience Buddhists that say, oh yeah, they could be a Christian too. In our sense, we've got to choose. I mean, you can't be a Buddhist and a Christian. You know, it's like you're like turning in your passport. I mean, you're kidding yourself, you know. On the other hand, we're perfectly prepared to say I'm an American and a Christian. And that seems to me far more contradictory than to say I'm a Buddhist and a Christian. But I think a lot of Asians might, you know, they're willing to say, you know, if you say I'd like you to accept Christ or come into Christ, and unless you said, and then I want you to deny, say, Hinduism, which is another way of saying deny your culture and deny yourself, your history, it would have been an impossibility. I mean, it's not something they choose not to do, it's something they couldn't choose to do. I don't know if there are in Asia, you know, people who are just resent Christianity, and I didn't encounter any myself, but I haven't had that much experience.
Just want to put in a plug for at least 6 books in the library and the bookstore on meditation, and the fact that the earliest mantras were Christian mantras, Lamb of Jesus Christ, Lamb of God, have mercy on us. The whole idea of the rosary, of stilling the mind, if anybody's interested, I think the best one as far as a starter for meditation, using Buddhist Zen and a lot of things, is Bill Hume's book, Let the Spirit In. It's an excellent first step explaining world religions, how they meditate, and how that can very easily be incorporated into Christian meditation. It's very fun.
I was a little disturbed about what you quoted about Mother Teresa, because in a sense she would be, the way I would understand her, be in first, what is it, precious truth, or what do you call it? Noble truths, the suffering, the life of suffering, and what I've heard her say is that love is suffering too. and from that point of view, I think she fit all right into the Buddhist thing.
Yeah, I think the Indians are devoted to. I from everything I've seen and read about Mother Teresa, they're devoted to her. The one point of conflict is her repudiation of birth control, which with the authorities, you know, she takes a Catholic stance on birth control, and that's a point of contention. But otherwise, I think she's just beloved. I mean, the Indians think of her as a saint. Part of it, for Buddhist, I mean, one could say for Buddhist reason, it's just Christian just as well. She labors without worrying about the fruits of her labor, running statistical charts. I mean, you know, what is this? You're doing the utterly impractical thing of bringing terminal cases in so they can die in dignity. What, you know, yeah.
I just want to make two connections with what we're going to do with Thomas Merton, and then we'll have a chance to do them next week. First of all, it seems to me that Merton senses more than most Western Christian monks, writers, that the scriptures are an Eastern book. Part of that which is in conflict is not so much our Christianity, but our Western or U.S. cultural assumptions that have shaped it. So that when he begins New Seeds of Contemplation, the first sentence, if I remember correctly, contemplation is, first of all, to be alive, aware, and awake. Well, that certainly makes some connections with page 66 and other things that you said today. Then in Rain and the Rhinoceros, which I hope we do as the reading session for those who choose it, rain is the rhythm on a roof over which you have no control and you celebrate that nobody started it, nobody's going to stop it, but as long as it rains, I celebrate it, and it is not the rhythm of the engineer. That's the first part. Always in always set against the rhinoceros, which is the play, UNESCO's play, Man in a Rush. So that at one point he said, do I have to have some reason for being here in the woods? He said, if there were not someone tonight alone in the woods in the rain, the world would have ended. That's certainly more in line with some of the things you said about the Buddha than the typical activist Christian expression of the faith. So we'll have some connections next week and the week after.
And I actually think this isn't as opposed to the activist stance as one might think. For example, Thoreau went on to become a very passionate activist. What's interesting, now again, maybe biblical studies have cleared this up, but my understanding still is that we know there's a hiatus in Christ's life before he began his ministry about which we know nothing. It's not inconceivable to me that he spent that time, not literally like Thoreau, but like this. And part of it is this, that you center down, Thoreau claims, get away from society to get at truth. If you jump prematurely into social roles, which is what your parents and everyone want you to do, you've got no resources to challenge society. He says, I'm ashamed of my good behavior. And what he means is, I'm ashamed for doing what I was told to do as a good boy. You've got nothing to set against society. Partly the community discussion the other night said that you've got to be really active in a community. You've got to be mature. You can't find yourself in community. So to just remove yourself and center down on truth until you become embodied in it, it seems to me would make you an inevitable and incredibly powerful revolutionary just in your mode of being. I mean, you walk out, you wouldn't choose to do just by what you were. And I think that in Thoreau's case, he became so centered on freedom and self-determination that later he could not help but passionately fight against slavery and imperialism. I mean, he had no choice. It's what he was. He didn't wake up and say, I think I'll do that, or yes, I'm persuaded that that's bad. He just, everything in him cried out against it because he had become so centered in the contrary truth, say, during this period. Well, part of it, and again, in And by the way, we've set aside the development of Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism, which is the most popular form of it, is completely different than what I've said. I mean, Buddha is in that Buddhism a savior. There's ritual, there's, you know, all the stuff that the Buddha rejected. But, yeah, I don't know. It would probably be, I'd guess, it's the Hindu notion of self that's there. Buddha, actually, the Buddha did deny the existence of soul, though he did affirm reincarnation, which implies some continuity, you know, laws of karma. And I suppose one could wrestle with that in whatever way. The Hindu notion of soul is that under the Atman, the individual soul is Brahma, God. And they would distinguish between self, which is personality, me, Eric Nelson, with certain traits and unconscious and whatever, and the God, which is deep, you know, within me. And hence nirvana, that sense of blowing out a candle, which seems so negative to Westerners, given our sense of self, but in Eastern sense is not emptiness or annihilation, but being taken up into an infinitely more joyous and full being, kind of like getting, you know, being locked up in a smelly lavatory. And after a while, it starts smelling good to you, you know, and you think, gee, this is nice. It's an old Icelandic proverb, everyone likes the smell of his own farts. But then someone opens the door and wow, you know, all around, and you go out. That's, you know, but there is a difference, I think, between, I don't mean to put down the Christian notion of self or anything, but to suggest that the annihilation of self in need not be purely negative, or that the Indians don't, that self is a capital S as opposed to a small s, being absorbed into God.
I think for those who don't know you, that you've given only one map or one best whatever chapel at St. Olaf, and part of the reason you were never asked back is you said fart.
Oh, no, actually, I did give others. No, I did give others,
oh,
but
yeah.
That was the last one. Oh yeah, was, yeah, Luther, von ein Traugen Ars kann man keinen fröhlichen Furz erwarten. From a sad ass, you can't expect a cheerful fart.
As long as it's Luther, it's all right. Yeah.
No, I think they were angry that I had quoted Luther in that way. I mean, they've forgiven him for being German, for drinking beer, for farting, for being constipated, and why bring all this up again? One thing I just interested in terms of this, because it bears on the thing of Holden and community, how life here can affect, or you know, quietude affect something later. There's a marvelous, I won't read through it, but there's a marvelous on the last two pages anecdote he tells of how a table that was, I don't know, 100 years old or something, and had been moved around several places. Suddenly this bug or something that had eggs had been laid in the wood originally and heated up by some pan or something. It suddenly, a moth, I forget what it was, came out of it. That had been, it's the last two pages. What it was, an egg had been deposited in the living tree, and then the tree had been cut down, and it had been made into a table, and the table had gone all over the place. And then somehow, this whatever was in the egg was awakened, burrowed through, and flew out of the table one day. What in the world? And they conjectured that maybe something hot put on the table had awakened, warmed it up or whatever, and restored it. It had been dormant all that time. And his parable was that you can't tell. You can have an experience in life that changes you deeply, and you're totally unaware of it at the time. Say something like, hold. You go out, and your life the next month is no different. Your life the next year is no different. Your life for the next 8 years is no different. But 10 years, everything's different. When we look at Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, we'll see someone for whom that happened. All of a sudden, he went, you know, he had an experience and it seemed to, he said, well, okay, right, it's not for me. Went out and lived a normal life, forgot that. And then suddenly, 10 years later, his life turned on its end. he didn't know what was happening. He became God-possessed in a way, I think. And he didn't, trying to figure out what happened. And it took him so long because what had happened began way back when he didn't even know anything was happening. And again, this is part of the sense of patience, of, you know, clinging to consequence, you know, knowing, looking at and anticipating consequences, calculating effects too narrowly. So I guess it's a quarter action. Or
are there readings in the
weeks,
even though the
what I would do, you might also jump ahead and read conclusion if you're going, but otherwise I'd just progress at your own pace. Another book, I mean, just having World and Time and Opera, if you want to take a break from Thoreau in preparation for next time, read the Schramm's book, or in the Schramm's book, The Way of Peace. And just raise questions. I don't see this as, we can just forget about the Buddhism. I mean, in later sessions, we don't need to stick to that. It's just one perspective. And I'd invite the Schramms to challenge Thoreau, as he would like, you know, saying, you know, when we built the farm, my God, we didn't have time to to do anything but labor. Where was this, you know, great spaces for, or whatever, to just, like, for next time, you know, read at your own pace, and then I guess your experiences would be the basis for the discussion, and people could ask questions, you know, just respond to what happened to you. You might want to distinguish, you know, your experience from what Thoreau's was, or and then, you know, maybe some of you have had this kind of experience and would want to bring that to bear, too. So I guess I'd see it loosely, and the focus is determined by the people who are leading each session. Does that seem okay?